I don't mean to alarm anybody, really. I don't. But this is actually a serious question. What is going on with this economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today the 9th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, here is a thought. What if we have come to a place in this economy where the rules for figuring out what's going on, what to pay attention to and what interactions to look for, what if those rules don't apply anymore? Because that's kind of where we are, and there are decisions to be made about where we are going to go economy-wise. Neil Irwin writes on the economy for the New York Times in The Upshot. He had a quick series last week on exactly that topic, this economy, where it's going, what to make of it. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Kai.
The through line of this trilogy, I suppose, that you did last week was that it's really hard right now to make a definitive statement of where this economy is. Yes?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, we've had this 10-year expansion, the longest on record. The unemployment rate stays extremely low by historical standards. And yet at the same time, we're not seeing evidence that the economy is really bursting at the seams the way you would expect it to with a 3.7% unemployment rate.
Let me pick an example or two. You wrote about the yield on the 10-year Treasury note, which we talk about a lot on this program, and the burgeoning deficit and how they are not doing the yield on the 10-year is not doing what one would think it would do at a time of rising deficits and debts.
Yeah, so we went from relatively small deficits into 2015 to quite a bit larger ones today, and yet the long-term interest rates have fallen, not risen. So the old story that we all learned, certainly I learned in college, that the reason you don't want deficits is because you'll get crowding out, and that means that the government borrows all this money, it forces up interest rates, and that means there's less money available to the private sector for investment. That's supposed to be the entire story of why deficits are bad, and it's not what seems to be actually happening in the world we live in today.
How is this playing out in the land of economic policy, both fiscal, what the Congress is doing and the president is doing, and what the Federal Reserve is doing with monetary policy?
I think it's making a lot of people rethink what we know. And, you know, we're in this world with global slump, global slow growth, demographic change, global abundance of capital. Maybe in that world, you don't really have to worry about crowding out. Maybe in that world, we don't have to worry about inflation arising just because the unemployment rate is low. And that really raises profound questions about whether we've been making policy wrong all along and what it should look like in the future.
Here comes an admittedly oversimplified layperson's question, and it goes like this. Look, Neil, this is all great, but we're adding jobs to beat the ban in this economy. There's basically no inflation. I've got a job. What's the problem? Why do we have to worry about what the Fed's doing and what Congress is doing and why this doesn't make any sense?
Look, I think that's a fair view. This is a pretty good economy. I think that the risk is that we don't have a lot of wiggle room if something goes wrong. The Fed doesn't have room to cut rates in a recession the way it has historically. And moreover, it suggests that maybe we could make things better yet. You know, if we, you know, maybe if there was more fiscal, you know, if we took advantage of these low rates to do interesting things with the federal treasury, maybe you might actually end up with an even stronger economy, higher wages, and an environment where more people feel really connected to the economy.
Or maybe not, right? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe you sow the seeds for a future crisis. Right. Maybe, in fact, all these traditional historical forces will kick in eventually. We're just not there yet, and we need to still be cautious.
Okay, all of that, then, in summary, let me ask you what we're going to hear from Jay Powell, who speaks before Congress tomorrow and Thursday, I suppose, just because this does seem to come down to what is Jay Powell thinking?
Yeah, I think what we'll hear from him is similar to your point just a minute ago. Hey, inflation's low, the job market's strong, stop complaining. This is a pretty good situation. At the same time, I think, you know, looks like they're probably going to cut interest rates, perhaps in a few weeks, maybe maybe a little later than that. I think he'll frame that as a risk protection, kind of an insurance rate cut in case some of these signs of a global slowdown really cause more damage to the U.S. economy. I think he wants to get ahead of any potential weakening in the global environment.
Neil Irwin covers the economy writ large for the New York Times. He's also got a new book out about which we spoke on this program. It's called How to Win in a Winner-Take-All World. Neil, thanks a bunch. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Jay Powell on Capitol Hill tomorrow and Thursday, as I said. That's going to be some testimony to watch. On Wall Street today, they were of mixed minds, actually, about what the Fed chair is going to say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. were talking a little bit yesterday about how some keystone economic issues in this country always, always, always get wrapped up in politics. Interest rates, I think, was the issue at hand yesterday. But there is another one today. The federal minimum wage, currently $7.25 an hour, been there since 2009, although some states have set theirs higher. The House is getting set to vote on a bill that would raise it to $15 an hour nationwide by 2025. That could lift 1.3 million people out of poverty, raise wages for some 27 million workers, so says a recent report from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. But the CBO also figures that 1.3 million workers would lose their jobs. So with that as a scorecard, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at what the future might be for this very partisan economic issue.
Are those job losses worth the wage gains? How you answer that question will determine whether you think raising the minimum wage is a good idea or not. What the CBO report does is remind us there are trade-offs, says David Newmark at the University of California, Irvine.
I think most sensible views of minimum wages say neither that minimum wages are an unambiguous good nor that they're an unambiguous bad, but rather they help some people and they hurt other people. That's what my research for decades has been saying.
Newmark says the loss of 1.3 million jobs isn't trivial. For those workers, it could have serious and potentially long-term costs.
I don't want to minimize that some workers may lose their jobs.
Sandra Black is a professor at Columbia University and was on the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama. She thinks the CBO might be overestimating the potential job losses. Even so, for her, the key here is the far greater number of people who will see wage increases.
Overall, the benefits vastly outweigh the costs in terms of employment, even under the assumptions that they make. The benefits clearly outweigh the cost.
The CBO doesn't make policy recommendations, so it doesn't answer the question of whether raising the minimum wage is a good idea or not. That decision is left to lawmakers, with Democrats mostly favoring an increase and Republicans largely opposed. Jonathan Meir is a professor at Texas A&M University.
I'm afraid that the minimum wage wars are heavily entrenched and that most people have sort of picked their side.
He doesn't think a new report or new data is likely to change many minds. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Were I to go out on Figueroa Street outside Marketplace World headquarters here in Los Angeles and ask people what IBM does, most would probably say it makes laptops and it's the company behind Watson, the Jeopardy-playing supercomputer. The second part is right. The first, not really so much, because IBM stopped making computers back in 2005. International Business Machines, or Big Blue sometimes, has been around since the start of the 20th century. It was the computer company for a lot of those years. So if it's not making computers now, what exactly does it do? Marketplace's Jack Stewart has the details on a deal that IBM closed today, $34 billion for the software company Red Hat, which does give us some insight into what it wants to be doing.
IBM in the 1950s and 60s was all about room-sized gray metal computers with punch cards and whirling wheels of tape.
Each tape reel stores the information contained on 2,500 cards, saving space, time, and money.
In the 1990s, carrying IBM's ThinkPad laptop with a red nubby track point became the mark of being a very important business person. Now IBM's work is all behind the scenes, says the company's Arvind Krishna.
We run reservation systems for airlines. We run dispatching for railways. We run ATMs for banks. So you really do touch IBM every day, but you don't necessarily see it.
Meanwhile, Red Hat specializes in open source Linux operating systems. Together, the companies plan to offer something new, a hybrid cloud platform. IEEE fellow Karen Panetta at Tufts University says that is something that businesses have been wanting to take advantage of.
Hybrid essentially allows you to say, well, I can do computing either in-house or utilize the power of larger public servers.
IBM isn't pulling in as much money as it used to. Analyst Moshi Katri at Wedbush says this deal, one of the largest in the tech world, might help keep the company relevant, but
it just feels that it's too little, too late, and it's just very expensive.
IBM says it'll have a leading position in hybrid cloud technology, which ultimately will do the same thing that early computers did decades ago. Save businesses, space, time, and money. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Okay, drugs. About which, two things. A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration rule requiring drug makers to put prices in television ads as a way to lower costs. That's one. And two, last week, the president said he's on the verge of an executive order that would force drug companies to charge the government lower prices. Details on that executive order are light, but it is an interesting question. Why do some other countries, Canada and Germany, to name just two, get a better deal on drug prices than the United States does? Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into that one.
A government study last fall found that Medicare pays as much as 80% more for some drugs than other countries. Rachel Sachs, who teaches law at Washington University in St. Louis, says the reason is pretty simple.
What all of these countries have in common is a willingness to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies and to say no if the pharmaceutical company doesn't offer a deal that the country is willing to accept.
The U.S. government, on the other hand, is prohibited by law from negotiating lower prices. So Rob Smith, with the consulting firm Capital Alpha Partners, says drug companies set higher prices here.
One of the ways that they, one, make up for those price controls, and two, generate money for R&D and what have you, is to charge more in the United States.
It's not clear exactly how an executive order would change that. The Department of Health and Human Services is already working on a rule that would set some drug prices based on an international index. To avoid making less money here, pharmaceutical companies may start charging other countries more. And Waleed Jalad at the University of Pittsburgh says, in theory,
then manufacturers, when they're setting their prices, will not need as much revenue from the U.S., and so they will set their prices lower.
Another scenario, he says, U.S. prices would just stay the same and other countries would pay more. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Ross Perot died today. He was 89 years old, remembered mostly as a colorful and game-changing third-party presidential candidate. But before he took to the campaign stage with charts and graphs talking about that giant sucking sound to describe what he thought NAFTA was going to do to the U.S. economy, Ross Perot built a huge computer services company, Electronic Data Systems. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on Perot's legacy as an early tech entrepreneur.
Ross Perot was a sales guy at IBM in the late 50s, back when computers took up entire rooms. Perot realized those huge computers could start digitizing the reams of paperwork filling up offices around the country.
Everything from payroll to marketing contracts to following who your customers were.
That's Gerald Posner, author of the biography Citizen Perot, His Life and Times. Perot left IBM and founded Electronic Data Systems, or EDS. Richard Schlackman spent years as EDS's general counsel and says Perot started pitching companies, saying, hey, let us handle your paperwork.
EDS says, we will furnish you the hardware, and we will operate your computers, and we will build your computer center, and we will just give you the reports you need.
The government started hiring EDS to process Medicare and Medicaid claims. Banks hired EDS to digitize customer information across branches. The U.S. Army started contracting with EDS. Schlackman says Perot's insight from the start was that companies that were buying these huge computers
didn't have the vaguest idea how to run them or how to get the most out of them.
Eventually, Gerald Posner says other companies recognized that too and started using EDS to launch their own services, like payroll processing.
There was sort of an ancillary group of industries that grew off of Perot's core business.
Perot became a billionaire when EDS went public in 1968. Today, EDS is owned by Hewlett-Packard. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
One cannot add more hours to the tenure of the day, and it's not a life well lived if it doesn't include play.
Time to get out of the office, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials basically flat today, 26,783. The NASDAQ up 43 points, about a half percent, 81.41. The S&P 500 found 3 points, a tenth percent, 29.79. We talked about IBM and its shape-shifting over the years. IBM down 0.8% today. HP, that, as Justin said, now owns EDS, the company Ross Perot founded, slipped about a half percent today. Healthcare in the news today as another court battle looms over the Affordable Care Act. Cigna declined 1.2%. Humana lagged about 1.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.06%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Smartsheet, whose work execution software empowers more than 77,000 companies and over 4 million users to plan, manage, automate, and report on work at scale. Learn how to move from idea to impact at smartsheet.com. Smartsheet, work different.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whether you like it or not, and some people actually do, personalized ads have become a regular part of the online experience. Advertisers and publishers use data about our clicking and streaming and spending habits to serve up ads for things we, in theory, want to see. And they are getting that data in part through the ad buying process itself, which is getting a closer look-see from European privacy regulators. Patience Hagen writes about digital media and ads for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
There are some nuts and bolts I think we have to do here first. Tell me what happens when I load a website in a browser.
When you load a site that has ads on the page, an auction happens in milliseconds where hundreds of players are bidding on that slot. As they're bidding, they receive data about you, about your interests, all kinds of sites you've visited before, where you live, where you've been. Thousands of companies are receiving that data for every ad slot on the page.
For every ad slot on the page. So thousands of companies times however many ad slots.
Absolutely.
Okay. And therein lies the dilemma for, so far, European regulators. Tell me about that.
European regulators are scrutinizing this process, looking at it closely to see if it violates European privacy law. The UK Data Protection Authority released a report last month that says this process violates Europe's year-old privacy law because it sends personal data about a person to thousands of companies without that user's consent. Those companies can collect that data and use it in ways that the users never consented to.
So this is the thing called GDPR. And the next question for you then is, there have been some small-ish movements in this country toward more data privacy, prompted in part by GDPR. Do you suppose that with the Europeans taking a closer look at this, American regulators will say, that every time, you know, an ad page loads and we see, you know, waiting for double click down there in the bottom of the page, that American regulators are going to say, maybe we ought to have a look at this?
Yes, they're starting to consider it. It's come up in privacy policy hearings before the Federal Trade Commission in Washington. It's just starting to become a topic in the U.S.
How much money are we talking about here from these ads in Europe and then stateside?
Worldwide, tens of billions. In the U.S., it's about $20 billion a year. For Europe, continent-wide figures are a little tougher to come by, but in France, Germany, and the UK combined, it was more than $4.5 billion last year.
Here's the catch, though. Without all of that data that these thousands of companies are getting in milliseconds about us, the humble internet user, without all that data, the ads are in essence useless, right? Or much less lucrative, we should say.
Right. The ads would be much less lucrative. Advertisers will pay a lot more to target an ad to someone who they know is likely to have an interest in their product or happens to be their target demo. So there's a lot of money for the digital advertising industry that's on the line here.
So now what happens? Regulators are looking at this. Are there active investigations? Is anything actually happening or are they just kind of thinking about it?
Data protection authorities in Europe do have open investigations into tech companies. And the issues raised in this report are relevant and could become important in those investigations.
Patience Hagen is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal writing today about regulators and those ads we see on the websites every time we go online. Patience, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Here's today's entry in the, so that's a business file. You might have missed this, but there was a brouhaha the other day about song lyrics. One of the big lyrics websites, Genius, accused Google of ripping off some of its content. Google said, in essence, it'll give credit where credit's due from now on. But in the meanwhile, the lyrics business model. Who buys them? Who sells them? Who pays? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
My niece Aaliyah loves to ask her parents' voice-activated speaker to play songs.
She's three, doesn't always get the exact name of the song, but a lot of times she knows some of the words.
Alexa, baby, you're a firework.
Firework by Katy Perry, starting now on Amazon Music.
Being able to tap a big database of song lyrics helps the Echo figure out what users like Aaliyah are asking for. Lyrics were once extras. If you were lucky, they were printed on the sleeve of an LP. Now, lyrics are all over the place. Spotify can display the words to a song while it's playing. And there are scads of websites competing to show up first when you search for the words to a song you just can't figure out.
For a long time, it was Google's number one search term on top of anything else.
That's Daryl Ballantyne, CEO and founder of a company called LyricFind. Understanding how this one company works tells you a lot about the business.
I mean, we started it briefly as a consumer-facing site, just to make some advertising revenue.
But Ballantyne soon figured out that his company had an intellectual property problem. Music publishers hadn't sued, but Ballantyne figured that was coming.
So we had launched it in March of 2000, and before the end of the year, we had taken everything down to try to get licensing.
Took them a while to make deals with song publishers, and the new LyricFind relaunched 4 years later with a very different business model. The company would buy the rights to display the lyrics, then resell those to other companies.
The economies of scale were not there unless you were providing that data and licensing to everybody.
Today, LyricFind resells rights to Amazon, Pandora, Metro Lyrics, and Google. If you've ever searched Google for lyrics and they popped up so you don't have to visit another site to get them, chances are good they came from LyricFind. But those intellectual property questions LyricFind wanted to avoid, those are still around. A lyric site called Genius recently accused Google of stealing its lyrics.
Genius is saying Google is taking the lyrics from our website. They're just ripping us off.
Janko Rutgers writes about technology for Variety.
But then Google, on the other hand, is saying, we're not actually doing that. We're getting that from third-party companies, from these lyrics aggregators.
In other words, from LyricFind, which didn't want to talk about the controversy. Nor did Google, nor did Genius. Ben Gross is chief strategy officer at Genius. He's quick to admit the business of song lyrics is pretty messy in some other ways.
When you license lyrics from the music publishers, they don't actually provide you with official lyrics or anything. So anyone who has a lyrics display license has to figure out what the lyrics are.
Genius sources a lot of its lyrics from what it calls superfans, those people who are more than glad to set the world straight on, say, what Elton John is singing here. Crowdsourcing lyrics doesn't make for perfect results, but you're also probably not going to find as many hilariously wrong takes anymore. You know, like this one from Phoebe on Friends.
I think the one that Elton John wrote for that guy on Who's the Boss.
What song is that, Phoebs?
Hold Me Close, Young Tony Danza.
Tony Danza, you know, the actor from Who's the Boss. Over the years, musicians have accused lyrics websites of stealing. But that tension's quieted down as the industry has figured out that artists need to get paid. Songwriter Adrian Quesada fronts a Latin funk band in Austin, Texas. He's happy to see some of his lyrics online, says it helps pay the bills.
One huge piece of the pie that I always push for and try to make sure is covered is the licensing part of it, because that could be a significant amount of income.
Quesada says when those checks arrive, he doesn't exactly know if that money is coming from someone displaying the lyrics or from a company using a melody he wrote to sell something. Either way, he's thankful for the extra cash. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
According to an analysis by McKinsey, the consulting firm, the average professional spends something like 28% of her work week managing email. You roll in Slack and texting, GChat, Facebook, and all the other ways people contact each other in this economy, and you can spend 40 hours a week just getting back to people. That communication overload is the setup for this next installment of our occasional series, Automatic Reply.
One can Snapchat, one can Facebook, Instagram, and tweet. And there's texting and there's email for communication fleet. I will not mention Tinder, because I'm not that kind of girl. The ways we have for contact can set your head a whirl. But one cannot add more hours to the tenure of the day, and it's not a life well lived if it doesn't include play. So it will take time for me to ponder, write, and then revise an answer to your query, perhaps untimely, but still wise. If you're in a frantic hurry and you simply have no time, please call the number set below this explanatory rhyme.
Virginia Seibert is a clinical professor of medical genetics at the University of Washington, says she leaves automatic replies on all of the time, and every 6 to 8 weeks comes up with a new rhyme. If you've got an auto reply you think I should see, marketplace.org is the best place to reach me. We do read them all, so give it a go, and perhaps, just maybe, you'll hear it on the show. This final note on the way out, today's installment of Who Gets to Decide on Interest Rates, the President or Jay Powell? Larry Kudlow, the head of the White House National Economic Council, did a CNBC event today at which he was asked, amid the president's continued sniping at the Fed and its chairman, whether Jay Powell's job is safe.
Yes, I believe it is. I will say that there is no effort to remove him. I will say that unequivocally at the present time. Yes, he's safe.
At the present time, which, come on, kind of reminds you of this.
Good night, Wesley. Good work. Sleep well. I most likely kill you in the morning.
Economic wisdom from the Princess Bride. All right, we're done. The Dow Industrial's down 22 points today. The NASDAQ up 43 points. That's about a 0.5%. The S&P 500 found 3 points, about a 0.1% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Joanna Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.